Comedian Julia Sweeney made the gender-ambiguous character Pat famous in the 90s. Remember that from Saturday Night Live?
Not quite sure how to address you.
No formalities here. Just call me Pat.
Now she's back with a new stand-up show at Second City. Plus, we take a look back at the year of this presidential administration and how it's affected farmers, coal workers, and more. But first, nearly 250,000 Puerto Rican residents have evacuated since Hurricane Maria. Thousands moved to Chicago. Journalist Martha Bain spoke with one mother whose family is still reeling from what happened.
Her son wakes up with nightmares every time the wind blows on a particularly stormy day here in Chicago, which happens a lot in the wintertime. It triggers him and triggers a little flashback, and he's scared that the hurricane is coming back again.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's been more than 120 days since Hurricane Maria made landfall in Puerto Rico. The island is home to more than 3 million U.S. citizens. But since the storm, an extended period of time without electricity, nearly 250,000 of Puerto Rican residents have evacuated for the mainland U.S. Most of them have landed in Florida, about 200,000, according to a study by Hunter College, but thousands have also moved to Chicago. Mayor Rahm Emanuel has said he wants the city to become the Houston of Hurricane Maria, a place to find safety in the same way that Houston was for Hurricane Katrina evacuees. But after having gone through such trauma and leaving your home, oftentimes with just the clothes that you have on, how are Puerto Rican residents coping with all of this, and what support systems are in place here in Illinois? Joining me now is Martha Bain. She's a freelance writer in Chicago who reported a story about this for Belt Magazine. Also on the line with us is Christina Pasiones Zayas. She's co-chair of the Puerto Rican Agenda. Both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
Martha, let's start with you. I mentioned that there's nearly 200,000 or around 200,000 Puerto Rican residents that evacuated to Florida. Do we have clear numbers on how many people are in Chicago or even in Illinois?
No. And that is largely because, you know, Puerto Ricans can travel freely between the island of Puerto Rico and the mainland United States. And so there's no immigration barrier to pass through. The estimate that I heard when I was working on this story by the end of, say, the middle of December was around anywhere between 3,000 and I think I heard one person quote 15,000, but the 3,000, I believe, is closer to the number that was being tracked by the Welcome Center at the Humboldt Park Fieldhouse.
Christina, we've had you on the program a couple of times to talk about Hurricane Maria, and I know, just to remind our audience, in the immediate aftermath, your organization helped mobilize people to help send pallets. You partnered with United Airlines to send planes to Puerto Rico. I wanted to ask you how your organization's efforts have shifted now that we're seeing, it's a big variety on that number, right? Anywhere from 3,000 to 15 is a huge variable in there, but certainly at least thousands of people who have evacuated to Chicago.
From the beginning, you know, as you mentioned, we were doing a lot of relief work, and we've kind of shifted our campaign and actually included in the language of our campaign, rescue, relief, and rebuild. And so essentially the rescue piece is an element that is used to kind of describe our support for the evacuees that are coming to Chicago. And so we were at the table when the mayor announced that he wanted Chicago to, you know, open up its doors and roll out the welcome mat for evacuees and for us to mobilize our members to extend their services and resources to evacuees. And so since October, when that initial announcement was made, we've been at the table kind of trying to coordinate and align efforts and be a little nimble as, you know, as situations arise and really pinpoint where are the barriers at the policy level and where are the barriers at the practice level and how can we troubleshoot and work through that? And specifically, I just received a report yesterday. The Hurricane Resource Center has served 1,775 individuals since opening back in November.
And that's the Hurricane Resource Center in Chicago, Christina?
Correct. It's a Humble Park Field House.
Okay. So when I wanted to ask you, when someone first lands here in Chicago, what are the most important things that they need?
Shelter, housing, winter clothes, employment, and then basic necessities, and even further, you know, some kind of inquiry into their status of mental health. Because you have to think it's a pretty traumatic experience to have lived through the hurricane and potentially lose everything, and then to pick up, you know, what belongings you have and make that leap of faith and come to an entirely new destination that you may or may not have been to before.
As we mentioned that, as you talk about the emotional trauma, Martha, I wanted to play some audio from a piece that you did. The piece I mentioned was in Belt Magazine. Martha, one of the people you talked to was a woman named Mary Carmen Hernandez Galarza, and she told you how hard it was to go through Hurricane Maria and then evacuate. But then on top of it, when she got to Chicago, what happened, sort of the aftermath of that? And here's a little short clip of what she said with some interpretation help from Doreen Gouger.
When she came from Puerto Rico, they didn't have much of anything with them. I mean, they came with dirty clothes, they didn't even bathe. They weren't aware of what the media was saying, you know, what happened until she actually got here in Chicago. And so when she was, you know, in Puerto Rico, it essentially was kind of like, you know, this is just happening, you know, my area, my community. But she didn't realize the gravity of it until she actually came here, when she saw the news and articles and pictures and stories that she, you know, she saw people really, just the whole island was in devastation, you know. And she essentially, you know, was, you know, saying that, you know, she felt stripped of everything. You know, she felt naked, you know, literally and emotionally, you know, seeing that her beautiful island was just completely destroyed.
That's Mary Carmen Hernandez Galarza, who spoke to Martha Bain, a Chicago Fleerance reporter. Martha, I can imagine it's so tough for you as a reporter, and Christina, for you to hear that. As someone, I've lived through hurricanes, and it is one of those things where you kind of are in a tunnel vision of what's happening to you, and you sometimes don't see, because there's so much of your own immediate needs that you're trying to see to, you don't realize the devastation or the impact of it until afterwards. Martha, I mean, imagine that. Did you hear that from a lot of people?
I did. And I think that, I mean, the isolation of the experience of the hurricane was compounded by the, you know, the complete obliteration of the communications network on the island of Puerto Rico for several weeks at minimum. So they had, you know, there's very little access to information from the outside about what was going on. And then you compound that with just the experience of caring to your own, for your own basic survival. And Mary Carmen, for example, was, she was in the hurricane at her parents' apartment in a senior center in San Juan with her two elderly parents and her 10-year-old son. And so she was really the person kind of taking care of all four of them at once in this very kind of drastic crisis situation. What I heard from Mary Carmen and from other people that I've spoken to is that kind of, you know, there's a delayed effect, and it's very common when people go through a disaster. To, you know, you tend to your basic material needs. You look for housing, you look for food, you look for healthcare. But once all of that is taken care of, once your physical safety is secured, then that's when the trauma starts to bubble up. And Mary Carmen, for example, was telling me that none of them have slept well since September 20th. Her son wakes up with nightmares every time the wind blows on a particularly stormy day here in Chicago, which happens a lot in the wintertime. It triggers him. It triggers a little flashback, and he's scared that the hurricane is coming back again. So it's, you know, things like that that only start to manifest once your basic needs are taken care of. And I think that that's what's happening. You know, you hear that in reports from Puerto Rico, and I think it's true about for people who have evacuated as well.
And Christina, what are folks doing about that here in terms of, as you said, there's sort of the organizations that are working on people's immediate and basic needs, but what kind of mental health resources are there available for people as well?
Yeah, there's a couple of our member organizations who are providing mental health services, and then some of the hospitals that are in partnership with us, they may make referrals. But then there's also, you have to think about too, the concept of building cohesion. And so one of the efforts that we've been really involved in is ensuring that there's opportunities for evacuees to come together and to celebrate cultural traditions. We hosted a luncheon for them at the Hurricane Resource Center right before the Christmas holidays. We had a big festival and event for the Three Kings holiday, which is a huge celebration on the island. And we continue this, actually this past weekend, we had another festival at the Segundo Ruiz Cultural Center, celebrating a traditional festival that happens at this time of the year on the streets of San Juan. And evacuees were granted free entrance. And, you know, the idea is to kind of help alleviate some of the mental stress of all that they're experiencing. So, I mean, it's a layered and nuanced approach, but requires, I think, a lot of cultural competency to really understand how best to meet their needs.
And Christina, is there, it sounds like then I imagine it's really important, as you're saying, not to just have a therapist or group sessions or group counseling, but then just have, as you said, all of these different layers. Do you feel like there's enough support in place right now? Are you getting enough support from the Hurricane Resource Center, from all of these groups, from the city of Chicago to put this together?
We've had a great working relationship with the city and with the Office of Emergency Management and Communications. They've been very responsive whenever we flag issues, and they have really served kind of as a connector to the appropriate point people whenever there is something that comes up. I think that the concern is sustainability, because Illinois did not make itself a quote-unquote receiving state like Florida and New York. And so there's a limited amount of resources. Essentially, everything that all of our community-based organizations and social service agencies, as well as the city agencies, they're adding on to their current funding and caseloads. And at some point, there's going to be a breaking point, you know, in terms of identifying how we can continue to support this. And so some of our discussions have been, you know, how do we tap into the philanthropic community? How do we really push at the federal level to release these resources so that, you know, our community-based organizations, social service agencies, and city agencies don't become tapped out?
Christina, who would make the designation, and who would have done that designation for Illinois to be a receiving state? Is that something that would happen from the governor, and is it too late to do that now?
Yes. It would be the governor's office to the governor of Puerto Rico, but I think that the governor of Puerto Rico has to initiate it first. I'm not totally clear about who starts it. When the hurricane first hit and there were there was requests for the governor to send the National Guard, he did pen a letter to the governor of Puerto Rico, but it was incumbent upon the governor to accept that letter or to make a call to say, yes, please send me troops, and that didn't happen. So my understanding of how it works is that it has to be a request originally from the governor of Puerto Rico to our governor, and then there's a negotiation.
Okay. As we think about this, Martha, you talked to so many people for your story. We were just able to really, we're almost at a time, we were just really able to talk about one of them, Mary Carmen Hernandez Galarza. They've gone through so much, but I wanted to ask you about whether or not you saw signs of hope from the people that you spoke with.
Definitely. I mean, with Mary Carmen in particular, one of the things that she said to me, and this loops back to the question of mental health, was part of kind of healing and coming to terms with the trauma that her whole family has gone through is involves being able to tell her story and feel like she's being listened to. And I think that is happening in Chicago through community-based organizations like the ones that are represented at the Resource Center,
and through other more ad hoc, you know, ad hoc situations. Mary Carmen and her family did find housing right at the last minute. Just as I was wrapping up my story, she got a she was found housing through the CHA in a development. And so that was, they were pretty excited about that because they were living in a temporary shelter. It was a family shelter, not like a dorm type situation. They had an apartment, but they could only stay there for 4 months. So the clock was ticking on that. And I think that she at least has been, you know, she has expressed a great deal of gratitude to me about the way that Chicago has reached out to her and her family. And I've heard that from other people who have had much. I've spoke with Mary Carmen extensively, and other people, you know, not quite in such detail, but they have felt welcomed here. Obviously, we have a very strong Puerto Rican community that has mobilized. And even though Chicago is, you know, not seeing the numbers that you're seeing in places like Florida or New York, it's really interesting to me to see how strong the response here has been.
Christina, very quickly, we're out of time, but are you still accepting donations and help?
Yes, our campaign is still up and running. You can visit www.puertoricanchicago.org, and there's different avenues to donate. And we report back how we use our funds via our website and also our social media avenues.
That's Christina Pasiones-Zayas. She's co-chair of the Puerto Rican Agenda. I want to thank Martha Bain as well. We'll tweet out her story about Mary Carmen that she wrote for Belt Magazine. Both of you, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate the story and the headlines.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're a fan of Saturday Night Live from the 90s, you might recognize Pat, the gender-ambiguous character that was played by cast member Julia Sweeney. And actually now, in the new millennium, Pat's gender fluidity is as timely as ever. And Julia Sweeney, too, is also back with a fresh stand-up workshop called Older and Wiser at Second City in Chicago. The comedian, author, and actor is based in the Chicago suburbs and has spent her time since Saturday Night Live exploring issues like family, cancer, and religion through her comedy. Her monologue, God Said Ha, about her and her brother's struggle with cancer, was turned into a film produced by Quentin Tarantino. She also wrote a memoir called If It's Not One Thing, It's Your Mother, and another monologue, Letting Go of God, about becoming an atheist, was made into a film for Showtime. We got to see her latest stand-up act recently at Second City. It's running at the Theater's Chicago location through March 18th, and Julia Sweeney is with us right now from our studios at Northwestern University in Evanston. Julia, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
So you're calling the show Older and Wiser, a workshop. Before we get into the material, I'd actually never been to something like this before. You offered a disclaimer to us in the audience that you're working through this material. How does this whole process work?
Well, first of all, it's actually older and wider. You're so sweet to think that it's older and wiser.
Oh, right.
Older and wiser is good. And yeah, I mean, that's kind of how I've always worked on my shows. I mean, I don't know how anyone does it any other way. It's just that when I did it before, I was doing it in New York and L.A. where I had relationships with a whole bunch of different theaters. So I just kind of went around and, you know, I would book 5 Thursdays at the Knitting Factory or, you know, like, and then I would just get up like for Letting Go of God and just do what I was doing that you saw. I just have notes and I have stories I've told in my head, but I haven't really said them out loud. And I don't know how they'll feel once they're on their feet. And there's just no way to do a stage show without doing that kind of workshop work. And So when Second City, I happened to be there for another long story, but I was spending a lot of time there, and I'm not from Second City. A lot of people think I am, but I'm not. But so we started talking about it, and I said, I think I'll do a show. Maybe I'll do a workshop. And they said, well, we have these workshop spaces. So that was really exciting. So that's how I got to do it. But I always feel worried about in fact, actually, this weekend, I'm going to try to not have a disclaimer like I had for your show, because I don't want to start with an apology. That's always bad. On the other hand, I really don't want people to think they're coming to a finished show. This really is like experiments that I'm doing on the audience to see if they laugh.
Well, I think they can tell that from the space, right? Because go into a space and it's not like your typical Second City stand-up space. It's a smaller room. They're like, what, did they find the worst chairs at Second City?
I know. Yes.
Like, it is a little odd.
It is
the
odd.
Chair arrangement.
It's 50 seats and it's just sort of their odds and ends chairs. But you know what? I was just telling my daughter this morning, because I'm not sure how I'll open the show once I get it ready. And I said, you know what? If they just kept me in that room and actually just officially opened it, I'd be perfectly happy. Because I like the 50. I like 50 people is a good number of people. I like it.
Well, and I also wonder, I think it's a lot easier for you to read the room. And so stand-up is a newer thing for you. You also talked about how it's a different space for you. I don't know if you feel, I was there when you were talking about holding the microphone and how it felt. And how you were trying to look casual holding the microphone.
See, that's my other thing I'm going to try to do this weekend, is to not talk about how I never hold the microphone. Just actually try to hold the microphone.
Is it uncomfortable for you to do stand-up?
It is different. Well, stand-up has changed actually a lot since I moved to Chicago 10 years ago. It's much more storytelling-y. I think The Moth and people like Mike Birbiglia, and it has moved more towards storytelling, which is closer to what I was doing. On the other hand, I really was doing monologues, and I'm realizing how much fat I had in it. Like, so what I like about stand-up is you're really trying to put down where the laugh is and then cut out every piece of information that isn't necessary to get that laugh. And that is not how I thought of monologues. Like, I just thought of the story I was trying to tell and the emotional impact I was trying to create. So it is different. On the other hand, it also feels like I was really close. Like, I would say, if you think of stand-up as the highway, I was the service road right next to the highway, and I was really pretty close to doing stand-up. So yeah, I'm excited about trying to see if I can really
off the service ramp.
Right, get off the service ramp and onto the highway.
Get off the service ramp and onto the Dan Ryan.
Yeah, exactly.
Stand-up. And then doing the experiments on us, the audience, is that different than when you're doing another act? Like, because I feel like comedians are always reading the room, right? They're always taking the temperature.
Well, in some ways it's easier for me, because I came up through the Groundlings in Los Angeles, which is like Second City, but in LA, and it's all sketch comedy. And then when I first started doing like sort of monologue-y personal story material, the thing that threw me the most was that the audience wasn't laughing. Like, I had to actually tolerate people not laughing. And then that was my big learning curve for monologues. Like, it's okay. You can feel that they're still into it. Like, when you're in comedy, it's hard to know if the audience is into you if they're not laughing.
Right.
You know? But I did feel like I learned that, or I pretended they were into it enough that I just kept moving forward or something like that. And then, so now in some ways, just looking for the laugh, even though I'm trying to get to more serious material too, and I'm trying to do a combination of stories / jokes, it's actually kind of a relief, because the results you're trying to produce from your experiments are very clear. They're laughs. In some ways, that's easier than doing a monologue.
Well, and then the whole idea of telling more of the stories and the jokes, I had a story that I wanted to share with you, but like this requires a little bit of a setup, right?
Sure.
So you're perhaps most famous to many of our listeners for your portrayal of Pat, who is the gender ambiguous Saturday Night Live character. Some of our producers were very young, and I don't even know how old they were in the 90s, but we'll talk about that in a minute. We have a clip of this for people who have not heard Pat before.
Who's this, your girlfriend?
Yeah, that's Dina.
She's pretty.
Thanks. So, do you
Do you have a boyfriend, are you married?
I was gonna be married, but it all fell apart.
Oh, boy, what happened?
I don't know, ask my ex-fiance. I can't talk about this anymore. I guess it's that time of the month.
Oh, okay.
Bills.
That's a clip of Saturday Night Live and the character Pat. That actor, Julia Sweeney, is with me now. She's got a new stand-up act at Second City in Chicago. It's actually running through March 18th. And Julia, you bring up this concept of Pat in your act now, but it's in the context of your daughter.
Uh-huh.
First, realizing, first of all, that you told the story to the show, that the show I was at, where your daughter came home one day and she was like, "Mom, are you famous? Were you on Saturday Night Live?"
Yeah, well, first, she had never even heard of Saturday Night Live. Anyway, so yeah, she was on the playground and some kids came up and said, "Your mom is famous. She was on Saturday Night Live. She played this really ugly, androgynous character that became famous called Pat." And Mulan was like, "Uh-uh." And then she went home and asked me, and I had to say, "That's right. That's your mom."
And then you do you remember you shared the response that she had where she said, "Mom, were you famous for making fun of intersex people?"
Well, yes, I know. She goes, well, at first I show her the movie and she's looking at me through the whole movie. She's so disgusted and sad that this is her mom. And then she goes, "I really feel like this movie is kind of making fun of intersex people." And then I kind of had a meltdown about it because I was like, "Oh, my God, was I the Al Jolson of androgyny?" And then that was so horrifying. It was like, what? Oh no. And then I had a huge defensive, you know, rage going in my head for days afterwards. Like, that's actually the opposite. I actually got a lot of letters from people who felt like they were glad that I was doing Pat, and Pat was embraced by the gay community, and I was the, you know, I was the head of three different gay pride parades in New York, like on and on and on. Like, I couldn't be more defensive. But then I had to kind of calm down and think about it, you know, like, well, the thing is, when I created Pat, I didn't think of Pat as, you didn't know Pat's gender. I was trying to just do a really annoying guy, but I really wasn't a good enough actor to pull off really being a male. So I threw in a joke at the end. This is when I was at the Groundlings, where you just didn't know what the gender of Pat was, just to kind of make up for my lack of acting ability. And then the audience really responded to that. So then that kind of took off. And I realized when I was showing Mulan the movie that I've always been really proud of Pat. And I thought Pat was interesting in a lot of different ways, even though Pat was so annoying. But if I'd known that Pat was going to become so popular, I probably would have made Pat more likable. Like the part that was fun for me to play was how annoying and all these qualities that really could be for a man or a woman. It really didn't have anything to do with Pat being intersex or androgynous. It was just annoying personal qualities. And that was my motivation to do the character. But then Pat became known for being, you know, androgynous. That was the joke. And then I got kind of put off by people who were too into that. Like, I would meet people going, I just can't stand it. You've got to tell me, what is it? And I'd go, well, does it even matter? Like,
well, it was like a Rorschach test. Well, and also because it's such a different conversation that we would have now than we would have had, you know, 20 years ago. And I mean, is the joke really on the people in those scenes who can't tell who Pat is?
Well, yeah. In fact, that was part of my big defensive screed that I was having in my head for the week after my daughter realized that I was Pat. Because I kept thinking, well, every joke, every laugh we got was not, I mean, the laughs that Pat got were about Pat being annoying. The real laughs of the sketches and the film were all about everyone around Pat not being able to tolerate it, that they couldn't know if Pat was a man or a woman. That's where the comedy lay. So it really, the joke was kind of on them. But I hated this idea that I might be remembered as somebody who played an androgynous character where I was making fun of that. But it is, speaking of adjacent, it is so close to it that it's so clear that that could easily have happened. But anyway, yeah. So I suddenly, because of Mulan, had to think through all these things that I had only vaguely thought through before.
Well, now you're older and maybe not, as you say, should we say wider or wiser?
I'm absolutely both wiser and wider.
But you joke about, and made me laugh, you joked about being called matronly in kindergarten.
Yes.
So do you feel like have you always felt old in a way?
Yeah, I think I always, well, first of all, I always was drawn to older people. I always had friends who were older, like way older. Like I always, like my, it started out with my grandma, my dad's mom, but even now I look back on it. Like when I went to college, I was in a sorority, which is completely wrong for me, and I had to get out of it. It was not the right social environment for me. I didn't really understand what I was getting myself into. But at college, I befriended this guy who was 60 years old, who his wife had died, and I met him in the cafeteria at the University of Washington, and we ate lunch together every day for 3 years. Like he became like this incredibly close friend of mine. And when I look back on it, then when I started my first job as an accountant and I was in New York City, not my boss, but one of the people at his level, which was higher than me, who was this older, wonderful Jewish guy. He had never married, never really left, grew up in Manhattan, never left, liked theater. I liked theater. And we became best friends. Like, and that's in my 20s, that's who I was hanging out with. So I always felt, I guess, older. Like I was related to older people. So that was what I was trying to get across, is that I feel so happy to finally be the right age that I've been waiting my whole life to be.
My guest is Julia Sweeney. We're talking to her about her new act, Older and Wider. There. We got it. And, you know, I wanted to ask you, Julia, I feel like you talked a lot about you've made your sort of your comedy after leaving Saturday Night Live, you know, going back to Pat, dealing with topics that might make people uncomfortable hasn't been something you've ever shied away from, right? And after leaving Saturday Night Live, I feel like your work only seemed to get more personal. Was that intentional?
No, it was accidental. I mean, it really started because after I left Saturday Night Live and the Pat movie came out, it was a huge bomb. And then my brother Mike got cancer, and then I got cancer, and my parents moved in with me, and I had this whole terrible year. It was really because of a couple of friends, one of which was Kathy Griffin, who's still a friend. And she kept saying, "You're so funny in conversation. Why aren't you just getting up on stage?" And I had a kind of snobby attitude about it. Like, no, my art is to be characters. You know, my personality is my gift to my friends. You know, like I don't share my personal life on stage. I had a thing about it. But because I was in such an extreme situation with the cancer and everything and my parents driving me crazy and I needed a release, I started going to this club called Uncabaret in Los Angeles on Sunday nights where Kathy was performing and just starting to figure out if she could do the same thing. And it was really like Margaret Cho and Janine Garofalo and me and Kathy Griffin were mostly the women who were doing it. And Beth Lapidus ran it, so it was very female-centric. And it felt more like group therapy with really funny people, like more than it was stand-up. And I just got comfortable telling these stories. And then at the end of the year, Beth Lapidus' husband, at the time, Greg Miller, had recorded all these shows. And he's the one who said to me, "You should listen to these because you've got some really amazing stories over the year." And well, at the time, I was just trying to get a job. I thought, I'll get up on stage and tell a bunch of funny stories at like something where casting directors can come to, you know, like as material. And then they'll see that I should be cast in TV shows or something. And then I got up and did like an hour of material of the cancer stuff. And everyone overwhelmingly was saying, "Forget about getting cast in something. Just this is what you should be doing. You should actually be doing this." So it wasn't intentional in any way.
We have to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Julia Sweeney. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Julia Sweeney of Saturday Night Live fame, but lots of other things, an actor, an author, and now has a new act at Second City in Chicago. It's running through March 18th. She's in our Evanston studio at Northwestern University right now. Having all of these women, you said it was sort of a female-centric environment. I wonder what it was like to be a woman in that environment back then, and if you think things have changed now also with women in comedy.
Well, you know, for some reason, I'm able to have this kind of bifurcated awareness of the world at all times, where I'm in a field and yet I don't know that much about the field at the same time, in ways that would always surprise everyone and me, myself. And the reason it relates to this is, even though in that environment, with all those women that I mentioned and this woman who was running at Beth Lapidus, and there was a lot of guys too, a lot of guys. Patton Oswalt was there almost every week. We were all kind of learning what we were doing. But because I was in that environment, and because I don't actually watch stand-up until last June, I really had probably seen Bob Newhart, Phyllis Diller, and Bill Cosby a full hour of a show. I mean, like, I just don't watch stand-up that much. I mean, of course, I'd see clips, and on Saturday Night Live, I knew the main comedians, you know, but I wasn't particularly a person who watched a lot of stand-up. That I didn't even realize until last June, when I decided I wanted to try to do stand-up and I was going to watch one stand-up special every day all summer on Netflix, which is what I did last summer. I actually didn't know that it was so male-dominated until last summer. I was like, where's all the women? It's like you turn on Netflix and you go to the comedy page, there's like 10 women for every 100 guys, and they're very specific, too. They're very young and they're sexual. But I'm just saying, I really did not realize how few women were in it. And then because I was watching it all summer, my daughter was watching it with me, and she was new to it too, but now she's 18. So last summer she was 17. And the cutest thing Mulan said to me was, "Mom, you're really going to do great in stand-up because look, they have hardly any women on Netflix doing comedy
specials. Such a low bar, Mom.
So they really need people like you." And it was so cute. And I almost wanted to be silent for a second after she said it. And I go, "Oh, Mulan, that's not because there's not funny women. That's because the business wants it to be the way it is. Believe me, there's plenty of funny women out there. They're just not getting heard." And that's when it was so funny. Like, here I am, 58 years old. I'm like, oh, wow, this is a very, I don't know if you've heard, but this is a very male-dominated field. Like, I really did not realize it was so extreme.
Do you think that's changing now? I'm thinking about all the conversations. I'm just thinking about even in Hollywood with women in the film industry. Do you think that comedy is also maybe changing?
I do, but in some ways, it's like I said, it's not just, it's bigger forces at work than just, like, say, pointing out gatekeepers who purposely keep funny women out. It's actually, I think, a bigger thing. Also, I think, I mean, what I'm saying is that couldn't change right away. I think it needs, you know, more time. I think because of, like, the Me Too movement and people being kind of woke about not just the harassment, but how unbalanced it is, it's going to help a little, but the cynical part of me just is waiting for the whole movement to get co-opted by some soft drink or something and the whole thing to fall apart.
Well, yeah.
Because, you know, like, it's because I already feel like it's, well, we'll see. I want to be optimistic. I want to be optimistic, but I'm unfortunately kind of cynical about it really making a difference.
I'm talking with Julia Sweeney. If you don't recognize that voice, the comedian has a new act at Second City in Chicago. It's actually running through March 18th. You mentioned talking about cancer. You've talked about cancer. You talked about your atheism. Is anything off limits?
I was going to say my atheism. It's like my daughter. let's talk about my atheism. She's so cute. No, nothing's off limits, I guess. Well, yes. Now I'm thinking, of course there's things that are off limits. There are things off limits. First of all, wildly untrue things. And that might seem obvious, but actually, like, I was working yesterday with a friend and who's a comedian who's was sort of, this is going to be so terrible, but he's just trying to help me work through this, my own Me Too story, and to see, make it funny and not freak the audience out with it. And one of his suggestions required Mulan to have an attitude about it that would be counterposed to my attitude about it, sort of like I do with the Pat thing. But that thing's absolutely true. And I realized I just can't do that. That is taboo to me. I can exaggerate or embellish, but I can't wholly invent their attitude. So to me, that's taboo. It really does have to be true. And then, yeah, I would say taboo subjects are, well, first of all, I have a family I have to live with, my husband and daughter. Like, my parents were fair game, I think, because I didn't choose them, you know, and I think your parents are always fair game for comedy. But I think your immediate family, you have to live with those people. You can't just be throwing them under the bus up there. So that to me is probably the taboo thing. Anything about me, though, cancer, sexual assault, atheism, politics, I don't think anything else is taboo.
Well, if you go to see Older and Wider, perhaps you will hear more about Julia Sweeney. It's on through March 18th right now, running some Fridays and Sunday evenings, and possibly maybe extended, Julia?
Yeah, I mean, that's the goal, is if it gets good enough, then I'll probably book a bunch more shows in April, and then we may really open it in May.
Julia, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Nyla. This is good. I'm so excited I got to talk to you. I listened to you for a long, long time and always loved it.
Oh, thank you. It's been a year since President Trump's inauguration. In an effort to look back on what has changed and what is ahead, our partner station, NPR Illinois, has been conducting a series of interviews with people in various areas, including the environment, education, immigration, business, and more across Illinois. It's part of a series they're doing. The series editor, Rachel Otwell, joins us now from WUIS in Springfield. Hey, Rachel, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's start with immigration and the idea behind this series. First of all, can you just tell me a little bit about what you all wanted to do?
Sure. So we have a few new reporters really on staff, and with that extra capability, thought it would be nice to reach out and try to get... Obviously, we can't really be too comprehensive here as far as getting the plethora of perspectives on the Trump presidency thus far, but we wanted to reach out to some of the sources we use on a regular basis as reporters and just kind of get their feedback as far as what actually changed over 2017 and what they have their eyes on looking forward.
One of the big ones that was happening a year ago at this time was immigration. This has been a particularly divisive issue for our government, even causing a shutdown this past weekend. Who did you speak to?
So I spoke with Lawrence Benito. He's the CEO of the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. And they're dedicated to promoting rights for immigrants and refugees. And they also educate the public and immigrants about just kind of the protections they have in place, as well as the contributions that immigrants make.
Let's hear what he had to say about deportations.
Well, certainly there was a lot of anxiety and fear. The president certainly talked about taking interior enforcement seriously. And since that time, we've seen an uptick in terms of raids. We're anticipating that workplace raids and larger scale operations are on the horizon, particularly targeting sanctuary cities. And so, you know, we're making sure that our folks are aware of their rights and are informed about what they should be doing to take the necessary precautions.
Rachel, based on the administration's policies in this first year, what does the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights have planned for the year to come?
Well, as far as legislation goes, Benito says he and others will be working on legislation to not allow specific registries of people based on their religion. There's the rhetoric out there about the Muslim ban, of course, and bans that have been enacted based on nationality. So they want to take a look at that. There's also legislation, they're calling it the Voices Act, which deals with victims of violence or witnesses to crime, and it would protect people for giving tips who might not be documented. And then they're also looking at legislation which is aimed at undocumented students and their access to college.
Another issue that people is important for people across the state is agriculture. President Trump campaigned to a lot of farmers. We're all affected by agriculture, whether we're farmers or not. Who did you always hear from on ag, and what was the big concern?
We talked to Adam Nielsen. He is the National Legislative Director for the Illinois Farm Bureau, and he was talking about NAFTA withdrawal.
Unless there's a major weather event, the price projections are not going to be high. They're going to be below the cost of production. And so we really do need an emphasis on trade. It would be great if the administration would get going on some of the bilateral trade negotiations that they've talked about.
So ending the war on coal was another platform of President Trump's campaign. He promised to bring mining jobs back by loosening air and water protections. So based on your report, Rachel, Illinois coal mines lost a little over 200 jobs last year. That was less than the year before. What is the Illinois Coal Association saying about that?
He says that he expects changes could be stabilizing for the industry, but not booming. Also, a loss of jobs, he says, is inevitable because a lot of the work is becoming automated when it comes to extraction.
Right. So that's according to Phil Gonat, the president of the Illinois Coal Association. One of your reporters, Mary Hansen, spoke with him for this series, looking at a year into the Trump administration. Let's hear what he had to say.
The changes made by the Trump administration by either revoking, repealing, or rolling back some of the changes or the regulations that were promulgated under the Obama administration have kind of stabilized the coal industry going forward. And I know the term had been used quite a bit that Trump was going to bring back coal. Unfortunately, that's just not going to happen. The major piece of legislation or regulation that he has stopped is the Clean Power Plan. And what that's going to do is, going forward, it's going to prevent the closing of more coal-burning power plants. We're not going to get back to the coal production where we were in this country back in 2008, which was 1.2 billion tons.
That was Phil Gonat, the president of the Illinois Coal Association. I'm speaking with Rachel Otwell of NPR Illinois. She spoke with them. Her report, lots of reporters at the station did for their series, The State of Trump, taking a look back at this first year of the administration. Rachel, Phil was advocating on behalf of jobs. What about the environmental arguments about this?
Right. So Mary Hansen spoke with him, and then she also went and talked to environmentalists who say they're concerned about the pollution of streams, rivers, and lakes as a consequence to the reverse of a rule protecting streams from coal ash. Areas like Sangamon and Vermilion counties, there's definitely concern there about the dumping of coal ash waste and its possible contamination of public water, which, of course, we use for things like drinking.
So the State of Trump series, we've talked about immigration, agriculture, coal. You, Rachel, you looked at LGBTQ issues. Who did you speak with?
So I spoke with Brian Johnson. He's the CEO of Equality Illinois.
On the national level, we are seeing a really big rise in anti-LGBTQ sentiments, particularly from the administration in Washington, right? We're seeing efforts to ban service members who are trans, a refusal to count us in the census, a withdrawal of guidance to schools for how they should be treating transgender youth, the appointment of judges for life that are vehemently anti-LGBTQ. I think in that context, seeing all of that happen in Washington, so many of our allies and champions here in the state just were willing to say those efforts and actions don't represent our values here in Illinois. And it's incumbent upon us to make sure that Illinois demonstrates its values of being a fully equal and inclusive state. I mean, all of our bills last year got votes from both sides of the aisle. We've just seen Illinois lawmakers double down on their commitment to full equality in this state. In an environment where that is particularly important.
That's Brian Johnson of Equality Illinois. Rachel, we just have about a minute left, but is there anything that surprised you that came out of these conversations?
Well, I think the level of hope that we heard was maybe not surprising, but certainly led to some nuanced conversations. Brian Johnson, who you just heard from, pointed to three major pieces of legislation that he saw as being important for LGBTQ rights and protections. You know, it's always hard to predict politics, and now that seems especially true. Todd Meisch was somebody else we heard from. He's with the Illinois Chamber of Commerce, and he said something that, you know, I think we all kind of hear over and over, and he just supports a lot of the policies the Trump administration is pushing for businesses. But he said one thing he'd want is for the tweets to be a little more reined in and for there to be some more order and strategy going forward. So we'll see.
That's the State of Trump series by WUIS, our partner station in Springfield. I'm speaking with series editor Rachel Otwell. We'll tweet out all of the stories if you haven't happened to catch them on your local NPR station. Rachel, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That does it for us today. We are out of time for the week. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.